line at the tables longer, so hopefully that this actually works out well. Last week we did just an intro. Nothing drastic. We covered the first couple of verses. And what is the... what's the theme to this book? What's the overriding theme behind this whole book? God is what?
Sovereign.
God is sovereign. God is faithful. And God is sovereign is the one we're going to see all throughout this book. He is the one orchestrating events, and actually the text actually states that in almost every single scenario here. We discussed a very brief history of what was going on here and what has led up to this point in time. If you actually look at, I mean, obviously I don't have the PowerPoints up here, but if you look at these slides and the PowerPoints I put in last week, you'll see that the book of Daniel and the book of Ezekiel, kind of contemporaneous books, both talking about Israel in the captivity. Talking about the southern kingdom of Judah. At this point in time, the northern kingdom's already been taken captive by Assyria. They've kind of been assimilated. The southern kingdom is now going into captivity in Babylon, at this point in time under King Nebuchadnezzar. And this is actually towards the last few hundred years or so, even less than that, of the Old Testament, before we get into those quote-unquote 400 silent years before the New Testament period. If you also remember, this is actually another foundational aspect of this book is God's faithfulness here. Okay? We serve a just, righteous, faithful God who has made a covenant with the Old Testament Jews. And part of that covenant was, if you don't do what I've asked you to do, I'm not going to bless you. And in this case, he's actually, we'll get into this way later on, you've got 490 years of them ignoring Sabbaths and other things, and God has now said, cup runneth over, I'm executing judgment on you because you have not done what I have said you, what I've commanded that you do. And now the southern kingdom is now going into judgment under Babylon. They're going to be in captivity for 70 years. And this is where we pick up in the book of Daniel. And we did the first two verses last week, but we're going to talk about them again very briefly. And this book gives us a time stamp. Here's in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And we talked about the three different sieges of Jerusalem. The first siege, Daniel was taken captive. Probably about, it's somewhere between 6 to 8 years later, the second siege happened, and now Ezekiel and the rest and another 10,000 were taken captive. And then about 6-7 years, if I remember correctly, later, the third siege happened, and at this point in time, Nebuchadnezzar was done playing with Jerusalem and destroyed the city, destroyed the temple, gone. We see in verse 2 a couple of aspects of God's sovereignty here. And we see that the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hands. The world sees things where the world does things and they reap the benefits of whatever it is they do. In reality here, we see God giving Jehoiakim, Jerusalem, the southern kingdom, into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar did not take it. This is part of God's plan. God is sovereign. He's the one in control of all of this. What else did they take?
The vessels.
The vessels?
Yep. Some of them.
And some of. We'll see later on when you get into Ezekiel and other passages. All the vessels are eventually taken. It's kind of a, like he took some, then took a few more, and then by the third siege, he's like, temple's gone, I'm taking it. Whatever's left, I'm taking it all. He also takes Jehoiakim as a prisoner. And we see the other side of God's sovereignty here, dealing with God being a humble sovereign, where he is willing to endure a disgrace in order that a greater purpose is accomplished. And we see here types of Christ and how God works in the Old Testament is going to be exactly how he works in the New Testament, even though it's a different covenant. We're going to talk today about where a lot of people, where you've probably heard all of these different studies on Daniel, Dare to be a Daniel, you know, Daniel died, pick every single one of those. They all come from essentially chapter 1. And we're going to start to see who Daniel is and who he really serves, how he lives, and who his relationships really are with. We're down in verse 3, and we'll go through verse 7 for right now. And let's see, Caitlin, would you mind reading verses 3-7, please?
Sure. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal families and the nobility, young men without physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter the king's service. Among these were some of Judea: Daniel,
Hananiah,
Mishael, and Ezra. The chief official gave them new names: Daniel, the name Belshazzar, to Hananiah, Shadrach, to Meshach, and
Ezra.
Ezra, sorry.
It's okay.
Abednego.
You should hear me try to read some of these names. I agree with Tim
on that.
Yeah.
I don't understand that. Could you read that?
Yeah. Names. A lot of Hebrew names are not fun.
No.
So we see that Nebuchadnezzar has taken these young men, and he actually has a purpose for why he took them and what he's going to do, quote unquote, to them. We start off verse 3, and we get this guy that shows up by the name of Ashpenaz. He is the head of the eunuchs, the head of the officials, depending on your translation. And I just want to stop and talk about this eunuch word very briefly, because everybody here know what a eunuch is. Okay. Your guy is not a fun thing. This word in the Old Testament is used almost equivalently, the exact amount, same amount of times, with the word eunuch, as we know the word to mean, and also as the word officials. Why exactly those two are the same, I don't know. But speculation is probably because a lot of people, especially if they were foreigners and they were brought in to be officials in a new country, they were made eunuchs because now they were not going to have wives. Their allegiance was essentially to the king. So a lot of the high officials that were foreigners were eunuchs. Not necessarily all the time, but that is the case with a lot of people. Whether we're talking about Daniel and these guys being made eunuchs, probably, but not definitive either way. You'll see different translations here, eunuch or official. Still makes the it changes depending on it changes your understanding here slightly depending on how you view Nebuchadnezzar and what he does to captives. Or it just makes it a general statement saying that they were just officials and they were considered officials in the New Kingdom. This word is also used of Potiphar back in Genesis with Joseph. So a lot of people will look at that and say, well, Potiphar was married, so therefore he probably was not a eunuch, he was just used as an official. But then again, look at the whole scenario with the wife and everything. So either way, run whichever way you want with this. It could very well be one or the other or both. So my translation uses officials, yours may use eunuch. Either way, you get the idea. Actually, after chapter 1, the word is not used ever again in the Old Testament. So that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Not saying it didn't happen, but the word's not used in the Old Testament. So Ashpenaz is the chief. He's the head guy of this group of officials, eunuchs, whatever you want.
Eunuchs.
Yeah. And he was charged to bring the sons of Israel into conformity with the Babylonian customs and traditions. Who are some of these individuals that we're talking about here? Just generally. What's their background? Who did Nebuchadnezzar go after?
Nobility.
Well informed.
Teachable.
Youths, okay. We'll definitely talk about that part. Why did he bring him in?
To train them.
What's that?
To train them.
Train them, okay. He's got a purpose in mind for them. He's going to teach them a whole lot of stuff and use them in his cabinet, his court. What this also tells us is Daniel is very likely from the tribe of Judah. Not confirmed, but very likely. Very likely, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael as well. Depending on who you talk to and how you translate certain passages in Ezra and other places, probably about 7,000 were taken in the first siege with Daniel. The only ones we really hear about are these four. So there's something special going on here. God's trying to make a point. Like Angie said, these four were youths. They were young individuals. This word typically refers to somebody in the 14-15-year-old range. So teenagerish. Okay. Smart enough to understand what's going on. Not necessarily smart enough or wise enough to make their own decisions yet. Okay. In other words, very impressionable. Okay. Anybody here who's ever had kids knows at this age it's very impressionable. You know, you kind of sway whichever way the wind blows, you know, especially peer pressure is a big one at this stage of the game.
In verse 6 of King James, it says, "Now among these were the children of Judah." Mm-hmm. So it says there right they were.
Yeah, I think directly for these four, yes, out of that tribe. This, I think they're speaking specifically there about just the southern kingdom of Judah. But yes, I'm one that believes they're talking about the tribe of Judah here as well with these four.
So it actually says Judah Heights. Does that mean...
Judah what?
Judah Heights.
Heights? Yeah. Read yours.
Among them from the Judah Heights were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah.
Okay, so that'd be more along the lines of the location of the tribe where, you know, the southern kingdom thing. Okay. So we're talking about young men. Let's just go right down the list. What other stuff was Nebuchadnezzar identifying in these individuals?
No physical defect.
No physical defect. That's pretty self-explanatory. Okay. Easy answer is probably no kind of handicap of some sort. What else?
Mine says skillful in wisdom and endowed with knowledge and understanding learning.
What's that mean to you, Angie?
Well, they've had some good education for the time.
Okay.
Whatever was available.
Okay.
And are able to discern the ability to use it.
Okay.
Maybe.
Is that useful to somebody who you want to put in your court? On your cabinet? Okay. You guys want to be able to think, be able to discern things, have some wisdom, that kind of stuff. What else?
Mine says they were well-favored.
Well-favored. What do you think that means?
Good-looking.
They must have been sorted out among some of the others that were.
Okay. Well-favored. Good-looking is another translation here. Or some variant of that. Handsome, I think, is in some other translations as well. What else?
Royal families.
Okay. Like we just talked about, they are part of the royal family somewhere along the line. What are all these things focused on? What is he really looking at in these individuals?
Capable of entering the king's royal service.
Okay. Right.
So.
But to what extent of that royal service, though?
Don't know yet.
To those that are above the norm.
Above the norm, okay. These are supposedly a cut above the remainder of the people he brought in.
These are the people that most likely would be leaders when they grew up.
Okay.
They might be people who could be mediators between the other Judahites and who could explain the customs.
That's a very interesting point.
And thoughts of how people think, so they could know how to rule them.
You've just taken 700 captives. Now, granted, we're looking... We have the benefit of 2020 hindsight here. We've seen all this. Half a decade or so later, you're going to have another 10,000 or so come in. It's usually a good practice to have somebody be able to intermediate between you and what you want these new captives to do in order to make the transition easier, less rebellious, those kind of things. There's already going to be some kind of rebellion anyway. You just lost the battle. You've been taken captive. You're in a foreign land. Not a good thing. Trying to ease the transition. Okay. Now, that's interesting because he's using youth, young kids to do this, not the olders. Okay. You get somebody who's more ingrained in the old system, it's going to be a lot harder to change them and sway them to come along your side and now be the mediator. But now he's using the kids to do this.
Did they mostly take the young children and leave the elderly people behind?
A lot of times, yes. In this situation, I think they just grabbed 7,000 of them. They grabbed a bunch of the young ones that they identified, and they probably grabbed a bunch of others, probably for labor or other reasons. It's, we're not really told, but if you look at some of the other reasons why they were taken into captivity, it's, And it doesn't help that, Nebuchadnezzar's probably going to make an example of some of these guys. But that's just speculation. Okay? Knowing Nebuchadnezzar and how we find out about him and what we find that he does with things, he's probably going to make some examples, not just for the remainder of the Jews that are still in Jerusalem and in the nation, but for all the nations around there, because Babylon has become basically the world power at this point in time.
Well, I would think, too, he didn't want to leave behind people who were powerful enough to maybe create a rebellion or to try to, turn things around.
Yeah. That's why you look at all these kings he left there. They're basically vassal kings. They're figureheads, useless, but they still tried to rebel because that's what they, they listened to people, and that's, they didn't listen to Ezekiel and Jeremiah and say, you're under judgment, let it go. And he said, nope, we're going to rebel. If you look at all these characteristics, they're essentially what the world looks for, isn't it? Good looking, smart, intelligent, charismatic, those type of things. That's what the world is looking for, and why am I not surprised? This is exactly what Nebuchadnezzar is looking for. I want this outward appearance to be as exceptional as possible because you're going to be in my court. Okay? And big surprise, this Nebuchadnezzar, we've all read this book. Nebuchadnezzar, a lot of I's and my's and me's. Okay? One of the other things we did not talk about here is they're going to be taught something in particular. And they're going to be taught essentially the entire literature and language of the Chaldeans. And we find out a little later, I think in verse 5 or so, within 3 years. Can you imagine trying to learn all American history and the English language and all that stuff in 3 years? It's possible. Most people would probably not do too well with that, especially if you're coming from another culture. Most of the, I work with some people who speak Russian and other languages, and they say, people who speak Russian and Chinese are saying English is one of the hardest languages to learn. Now, granted, Chinese is a whole other issue. So I can only imagine going from Hebrew to learn Chaldee, which apparently I've never studied it. I've seen a few words out of it, looking at it going, no, I'm not even going to try. But this is what he's doing. He's teaching them everything that they had to learn in 3 years.
I don't think it's really that far, because I think Chaldee became Persian Farsi, Persia, Babylon.
I think it got blended in at some point.
Farsi's always been considered Arabic light, so it's a Semitic language just like Hebrew. So it didn't get that far away at this point.
Well, college is 4 years, so you learn a lot in 4 years.
True.
There's doing it three.
I'll put it this way. I know how focused I was with studying when I was 14, 15.
Yeah.
I would not have been a good candidate for this.
Well, it's immersion.
I had no choice here.
If you're in Spain, you're going to learn Spanish.
Yeah. Exactly. So they're learning all the literature, all the science, all the history, all of that kind of stuff. And I found it kind of interesting because we look at the word Chaldean. And I think I mentioned it last week or not. The word is basically wise men. They will show up here in chapter 2, multiple other chapters. It'll be chapter 2, chapter 5, and chapter 9, other places. The word actually means magi or wise men. And the word actually translated means clod breakers.
Clod breakers.
Farmers? Yeah. Not entirely sure how you got wise men or magi from clod breaker, but that's what the word means. But this is all the book learning stuff. One of the other things I saw in reading on this was this is actually Nebuchadnezzar's way of taking Israel's future and making it his and corrupting it. Okay. He took Israel's future and attempted to indoctrinate it with Babylonian culture and lifestyle. What we find is at least four of these young men did not give in and they continued to follow the Old Testament law, the covenant. So now take one more step back and look at what Nebuchadnezzar is looking for and look at what God's looking for. Nebuchadnezzar is looking for all this outward stuff, the body, the mind, the intelligence, all the things that we look at. Picture high school. Picture the scenario in high school. What was I like in high school, and what did I gravitate towards? Or would I try to gravitate towards? Or would other people gravitate towards? It was the smart kids. It was the intelligent kids. It was the jocks. You know, the well-built kids, the handsome kids, the pretty girls, whatever the case is. Why are we not surprised that nothing's changed? But God looks at things differently, as we know. He wants a contrite heart and a willingness to trust and serve, sometimes in spite of what the world deems preferable. And that's what we're going to get into here with Daniel. So that's the kind of the reasons why he picked these individuals. And we're only focusing on these four, and we're really only ever going to focus on these four, and then after chapter 3, we're only going to focus on one. Daniel's the kind of like the ringleader, think of it that way. Okay. So we get down to verse 6. Okay. We'll come back to the beginning of verse 5 with the portioning of the daily portion and stuff like that. And we'll talk about the names very briefly here. Now from among them we had the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. We always know them as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Oddly enough, we don't refer to Daniel as Belteshazzar ever, except in here. It's always Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
Well, that's because there's a king that's almost the same name, which makes it really good.
Yeah. So let's see one of the other things that Nebuchadnezzar is going to do to try to indoctrinate them into the Babylonian culture. And he's going to change their name. Now, granted, the word text here says Ashpenaz is the one changing their name, but this is obviously at the behest of, at the order of Nebuchadnezzar. And we see the name, even in the names, they're trying to sway them, get them away from their old lifestyle and their old belief system. Daniel's name means God is my judge. Belteshazzar means Prince of Bel, or some variant of that. There's actually three or four different names there. So the focus now has gone from El, where you get Daniel, E-L, cognate there, you get the word God. You get, actually in the other two, the word Jah, which is a cognate for the word Jehovah. Here, they're taking God out of the name and substituting a Babylonian God in its place. So we've gone from God is my judge to Prince of Bel. Hananiah means favored or beloved of God, and that was changed to Shadrach, illuminated by the sun god. The god Shak. I think it's a goddess, technically. Mishael was called, his name means, who is as God or who is as Jehovah. And they changed his name to Meshach, who is like the moon god. Okay. Depending on your translation, maybe who is like Marduk or who is like Aku. And Azariah, Jehovah is my help, changed his name to Abednego or Abednebo, depending on your translation. Either way, Abednego is the one we know. And it means servant of Nebo or Nego or servant of the shining fire. As you see, all of these are now focused away from Jehovah God to a Babylonian God. And just another way to corrupt their minds and get them into this Babylonian mindset. One of the things I did find interesting as I was going over this, the word Nebo or Nego in the Chaldean is actually translated shining fire. And when you look at the Chaldean translation of the book of Isaiah, the word is actually translated Lucifer. Don't run with that too far. It's just I found that interesting. Okay. This is interesting now because, again, one of the characteristics we're going to see here in the parallels is living for Christ in a hostile culture. And one thing the world always seems to try to do is to take the Christian world or worldview and rework it to convey worldly ideas. So that's just a very brief, most people know me, I do the name thing a lot, but this is kind of a big deal because this is part of the indoctrination process for them. We get down to verse 8, and this is now where things are going to start picking up. And we start, depending on your translation, mine starts with the word but. Okay? You got the connection. But Daniel made up his mind, resolved, purposed, take your pick on whatever translation you have, that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Let's spend some time on this verse. Purposed in his heart, resolved to do, made up his mind. any of those translations. What do those words mean to you?
Mind was set.
You say anything?
He's making a choice.
He's making a choice. Okay, we'll come back to that. What do you think, Marco?
I just think of defile, like back in Leviticus, how something is defiled, it's unclean.
Okay.
So.
Okay, that's definitely going to come up here in a second. The word in Hebrew actually means to set, to direct, to establish, or to plant. Every single one of those is something that's involving setting your roots down into the ground and standing firm in some way. Okay? So Daniel purposed in his heart. Okay? Does anybody's translation say something other than that? Other than resolved in his heart, purposed in his heart, anything about this? Did he purpose in his mind? Did he resolve in his mind? Did he resolve in his feelings?
Mind just is determined.
Okay?
Yeah.
There's a reason why this word heart shows up here. The understanding of most Middle Eastern cultures, and even nowadays, even with the Greeks and passed on to the Romans, the heart was the center of you. It is your core makeup. So when they say something happens in your heart, it's happening in you. It's in your body, in your soul. It is who you are. They didn't look at the mind that way. They looked at the mind as an outcropping of what was in your heart, which there's a whole lot of truth to that. Okay. Biblically, it seems to go the other way, but we get the idea. It can go either way. But he purposed in his heart. He purposed in the core of his being that he was going to stand firm and do something, or in this case, not do something. Okay. And I don't want to take this from a negative way. He's actually going to do something. But it's something that's in opposition to what the king wants. So what do we know about Nebuchadnezzar? I know we're jumping ahead here, but what do we know about Nebuchadnezzar?
He's a lot like the Queen and Alice.
Okay, explain that.
Off with your head.
Okay. More appropriately for him, let's throw him in the fire. Okay. What else we know about Nebuchadnezzar?
I have my own way.
He wants his own way. Very prideful guy, very controlling. Does he take well to disappointment or not getting the answer he wants? Okay. We'll jump ahead to chapter 2 there. He couldn't get the answer he wanted, so he's like, off with the head of all the wise men kind of thing.
Yeah.
He's not a very gracious person. I'm probably putting that as politely as I can. Okay. This is the king that Daniel has purposed in his heart to defy this command. So, this is a 14, 15-year-old kid defying this type of king. Why is he defying the king?
So he doesn't defile himself.
So he doesn't defile himself. Who's Daniel work for?
God.
Okay. And I phrased use the term work for because I couldn't think of a better way for it. Okay.
Serve.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you. The first thing about this word defile, there's a very big implication here with this word. And the implication is that what he's being asked to do is wrong. It is not right. Therefore, he knows what is right. He grew up with God's law. He grew up in the Old Covenant. If you look at the timeline, he is probably right about that point in time where under King Josiah, who was the only good king of Judah, they found the law again. And they had this huge revival. So you have Josiah on the throne. At this point in time, you also have Jeremiah as the high priest. And Daniel's growing up in that. And then you get all the other kids after Josiah, which were just a mess. That's where he learned this. And then he's taken to a foreign land, still with all of that in his heart, knowing that God, knowing that covenant, and still willing to stand firm, completely separate from that. And only had, probably a few formative years of his life under that good period of time and that revival under Israel. And he knows intrinsically that I can't do this. You want me to eat this meat and drink this wine, and I cannot because that will defile me. It is wrong. God has said do this, and this is correct. Do we look at our life at work, or for those of us that are retired, those of us around, do we look at things like that where the world says do this, but God has said do this? And do we purpose in our heart to say, God has said do this, I'm going to do this no matter what the outcome is? Don't have to answer that, obviously. The word defile means something that is going to corrupt, pollute, or desecrate. That's all it means. But it means that there's some kind of blemish on it. It's not pure. Think of it that way.
I think it goes farther, though, in Leviticus. It goes into some pretty good detail about if you're unclean, you can't talk to God. It interferes your ability to talk to God. It distances you from God.
One of the funny things is Ezekiel, a contemporary of Daniel, actually writes about stuff like this in chapter 4, where he's prophesying about the captives having to eat unclean food in foreign lands, except for these four that we're told of. There may have been others, but that's what we're told of. I can't see Ezekiel doing this as well, considering he was also a captive in Babylon as well. But why would this be a big deal to not eat this meat? Or drink this wine.
Because it was probably offered to pagan gods, which would have been a very...
What's God say about that kind of stuff?
No.
Okay. Old Testament law, Leviticus and Deuteronomy. One, the food's got to be kosher. Okay, that's a given. Okay. If it's not kosher, you're not touching it. You know, if it's an unclean animal, whatever the case is. But we're assuming that this is probably a cow, some kind of meat, which is a kosher animal. So the problem would have to be something along the lines of how they prepared the food, what they did to the food before it ever got to them. And that's where Cheryl's talking about this. Most likely the food was probably offered to a pagan idol of some sort before it was ever presented to the king, because that was one of the practices they did at the time. Let's jump ahead a few centuries here, and we'll talk about this apostle by the name of Paul in the book of 1 Corinthians chapter 8. And we start talking about meat being sacrificed to idols. Can we eat meat sacrificed to idols?
It depends.
As long as it doesn't make a young believer stumble.
Okay, good. There's nothing in the New Testament about us eating meat sacrificed to idols. I'll just bring this out there just because people will have the question. Paul addresses this for pretty much three to four chapters, 1 Corinthians 8, 9, 10, and actually he mentions it in other places as well. We can do it if we want to. But the point that Paul's making, as Cheryl brought up, is if me doing this causes a younger believer, a less mature believer, to stumble,
don't do it.
No. And that goes for anything.
Yep.
Okay. I am free to do anything within the will of God. Okay. I am free to do... Grace is amazing. I'll just leave it that way, okay? But grace gives me a lot of leeway. And I can do a lot of things that other Christians may deem something I shouldn't do. You know, you'll see, I mean, we got over, 30,000 different Protestant denominations. I think that may be low nowadays. And you've got some that will not sing the way we worship here. You know, we got some that won't dance. We have some that won't drink. We have some that, whatever the case is. And those are all, quote-unquote, disputable matters. We'll use Paul's term. I can do any single one of those within the grace of God. As long as I'm doing it to glorify God, I'm doing it out of love for God, take any of the above you want to talk about. But I am not to abuse my grace and my freedom to corrupt or confuse the mind of a younger Christian because they don't understand it. I am now supposed to rein myself in to accommodate their maturity level, if I can phrase it that way. Until they realize, yes, you probably can do something like this. Now, many people will take this and run with it and go all sorts of crazy things and start abusing grace. I'm not talking about that.
Is it more grace or more your position as a priest?
A little of both, probably.
Because as a priest, you're an exemplar.
Yeah. I'd probably say a little of both. So there's nothing under the new covenant about this, but don't forget, Daniel's under the old covenant. We will go back and forth as we do this, and I will try not to confuse you as I do this. Old covenant law makes it very, very cut and dry. No, you're not doing it. Grace allows you to do it. Old Testament law says no, don't do it. And that's where the Old Testament is actually easier to follow in some senses than it is to live under grace. I have a lot of freedom. God gives me a lot of rope to hang myself with grace. The law, not so much. It's very clear. No, 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 no. Yes, 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 yes. So this is very clearly something defined in the Word of God under the Old Covenant that God has said no. And this is where Daniel draws the line. Doesn't care about getting a new name. Doesn't care about learning all the stuff about Babylon. But we get to something like this in the law, and God said no, and Daniel said, not doing it. I'm going to get to the point where I'm not going to do it to the point of whatever Nebuchadnezzar does to me, so be it. When did he make this decision? And this is probably a little too broad of a question to ask right now.
It would be pretty early.
I would imagine
before
so.
Before
he
got
yeah.
there.
Yeah. Yeah. The bigger concept here is Daniel purposed in his heart before this ever popped up. Okay, he knew what God's law was. He knew what the standard was. He knew what he was not going to do if it ever came to that point. This is the kind of relationship Daniel has with God and the kind of core he has.
Plus, he didn't have to stand alone. He had the other three.
He did.
Okay. Kind of encouraged each other.
John MacArthur says it this way: Daniel demonstrated great wisdom when he made a firm resolution in his heart to obey God's command, whatever might come. He recognized that he was faced with temptations and threats that would lead him into behavior unpleasing to God, and he determined in advance not to be led astray. The time to make a firm resolution to walk in God's way is prior to the time of temptation. I'm not sure about you, but for me, if I'm not preparing myself for the battle beforehand, I will never be stabbed in the ribs or stabbed in the back or get a shot in the face, one of the above, and then I'm like, There are actually times where I know it's coming, but it doesn't come in the way I expect it to come. There's something to be said about purposing in your heart and preparing to stand for Christ or stand for God in this case. Well, definitely neither case. To do that before you ever get into the situation. Most of us, and I'm saying this generally, I'm not at the point in my walk where my spirit is renewed enough where I can defend against anything without thinking about it and not preparing for it. Certain things I can, most things I cannot. In order to prepare for the fight, you have to know. Well, you have to assume it's coming. Okay. We know Satan's tactics. Okay. They're very simple. It's the same thing. Go back to Genesis 3. It hasn't really changed. We know the tactics. We know how to fight it. It's very easy how to fight it. Do I actually stand the way I'm supposed to? Do I stand firm on the Word of God? Do I wear the armor as we see in Ephesians 6? Do I put the armor on before I ever get into a fight, knowing I'm going into one? Most of us don't. Some of us do. Some of us do, and we still have problems. Okay? Depends on the fight. Okay?
I don't think it's a mistake that this is Daniel determined. That he doesn't say Daniel and his friends. Daniel singular made this decision. Hey, guys, why don't you put your armor on? You know? He reminded them what was right.
This is also tying into what Frank has been talking about in the book of Philippians. And we see the book of Philippians is all about having joy through adversity, ultimately because we have a renewed mind. We look at things differently. That's what we've been talking about the past 3 weeks, and we just focused on it in all of verse 8. It's all about having a renewed mind and how we look at things. This is actually Daniel demonstrating he has a renewed mind. Okay. We're not told this once in the Old Testament that the Spirit of God came upon Daniel, but it's blatantly obvious that the Spirit of God lived in Daniel. Okay. There's no question in my mind. Okay. What's a tool that we tend to forget about when it comes to purposing in our heart and resolving to do things for God?
Prayer.
I would venture a guess, and this is just speculation, Daniel probably prayed about this decision long and hard before he ever actually did it. But then again, he may not have, because it's very clearly defined in the Word of God, thou shalt not. There really is no point to pray if God said no, don't do it. But the prayer would not be, God, should I do this or not do this? It is, God, help me get through this thing. Okay, this is a help kind of prayer.
Honestly, I think that Daniel did know what was right, but I don't think that would have ever kept him from praying to God.
Oh, God, no. That's all he does. That's all he does in his book is pray.
Exactly.
I think that these guys knew what was going to happen. They certainly knew whatever they were going to run into was going to be for their king and their gods. And they, I think, corporately, they probably all, we know about Daniel because he was the bigger or the most central of the four characters. Mm-hmm. But I'll bet they had all said, let's do this together. We aren't going to stand alone against all these.
But I thought about that too, because I don't think in the book it also says that they tried to convince the others to stand firm I don't think it's in there anywhere.
No.
So I don't know.
Well, part of it is there's a guard. These four young men are part of a group that has a particular guard over them. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're about to get to. Daniel's going to talk to him and say, I propose this test. Well, that's convincing one guard that these group of individuals can try it is different than that guard and that guard and that guard, because they're all dispersed.
Right, but I mean, for these four to talk to their other captive buddies, who, you know, surely they knew some of them prior to being exiled, you know, and they're sitting in these classes and going, you know, after class, they're out in the hall and he's going, come on, you know better. You know, you see what I'm saying?
So let's stop there for a second. Okay? You're a Christian. I'm a Christian. Okay. Everybody in this room is a Christian. Uh-huh. Do we all hold ourselves to a different standard in how we walk our walk? Mm-hmm. It is very clear to me, Daniel and these three held themselves to a much higher standard that was even required. There's nothing wrong with eating meat, nothing wrong with drinking wine. Daniel does it later on, you see in chapter 10, you see in chapter 6 and other places. They go a step above and beyond. How does that look to another believer at this point in time? You're the holier than thou one. Mm. In some ways, he could isolate himself here as well from not only, you know, well, he could incur the wrath of Nebuchadnezzar and Ashpenaz and Melzar. Or he can also isolate himself from the other Jews, going, why do you think you're so much better than us? Don't know. This is strictly looking at it from a humanistic perspective at this point in time.
I think you've got three examples of three types of people. You've got Daniel, whose heart was right, who made the right decision. You have Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, who saw what was right and chose to follow it. And then you have everybody else who's like, but that's Cal. And they knew what was right, but chose otherwise.
So who's in control of this whole situation?
God.
Okay.
We see it very clearly in chapter 3 with the fiery furnace. It is, in no uncertain terms, spoken of by Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Mm-hmm. We're not going to do, even if God doesn't save us, we're still not going to do what you want us to do because it's wrong. We're seeing that played out here, just not in words. I'm willing to go to the fire because I trust my God, no matter what he does or doesn't do to me. Exact same scenario, just without the words. Now, granted, it's more dramatic in chapter 3 because they say the words. Same thing. We see here that Daniel firmly believed that God was in complete control of his circumstances, and he knew that the Lord would always be faithful to his people, if they would just be faithful to his word. Daniel therefore resolved in his heart to obey God, and the Lord rewarded his obedience with stunning success. Okay, now, obviously jumping ahead a little bit here. You're going to hear me probably quote this gentleman more in this book than any other book I've ever taught on. This guy by the name of James Montgomery Boyce. Phenomenal, phenomenal guy with commentaries, phenomenal preacher, everything. He brings up an interesting point here. Daniel not only resolved not to defile himself with the king's food and wine, but was also willing to put the matter to the test and prove God able in every circumstance. That's a completely different way of looking at this defiance here. It's not just I'm doing it because the law said so. I'm doing it now because I'm showing you my God is better than your gods. My God will protect me in any circumstance that he puts me in. He's obviously put me here. Why is he put me here? And if protection means he's taking me out of this world, great. You know, if protection means we go through the fire and the ropes are burnt up and we come back out on the other side, and testimony time. That's how he's looking at it. And it breaks the question, do we resolve to prove God able in any circumstance in our life? Obviously, you don't have to answer that right now. The interesting thing, though, is he is not belligerent. He's not obnoxious. He's not hostile. How does he approach Melzar here?
Let's make it.
Let's make a deal. In a sense, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. He makes a request.
Yeah. Yes.
That's all he does. He realizes his position.
But I think he goes farther than that. He actually has compassion for the chief eunuch in the guard's position.
Mm-hmm.
He understands what he's asking could kill them.
Yeah.
So he has his position, but he approaches them with understanding theirs first.
This is something we're going to see for Daniel all throughout this book. He is very charismatic in this way. He knows how to address people in the love of Christ. Okay? If that makes sense to you now. I've never actually phrased it that way here for Daniel, but you know what I mean. But this is not, it's not a belligerent thing. This is a very respectful, peaceful way of saying, you're causing me to defile myself. You're basically causing me to create a schism between me and my God. This is a religious thing, if you want to even term it that way. I understand I have no standing here. I have no say in the matter. I have no leg to stand on. But I'm asking you to help me adhere to the standards my God wants me to uphold. And he says this in probably the nicest way you can probably do it.
Okay? No, he even says, and if I do, he says, judge us. So he's like, if I maintain the standards of my God, you will be blessed for this. You will see benefit. He's saying, put us to the test. Because he knows that at the end of that time, he will be sustained more by the relation of his God than by the food.
We only asked for 10 days.
Yeah.
Any idea where that 10 days came from?
No.
I have no idea. I'm assuming it was out of a prayer, but it could just have been 10 days. We don't know.
There is something to do with fasting, because I've actually done a fast longer than 10 days, that the 10-day mark is significant psychologically and physiologically in a fast, so that any fast less than 10 days has less of an effect than one that exceeds that. There's a line there.
True, but I'm looking from it from the perspective of Old Testament law. But I don't recall seeing anything in the
But I'm saying is, I think that Daniel is familiar with fasting. He's probably done it before as a youth.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's like, well, let's go to a period of time that, you know, a lack of nutrition will definitely show.
Okay. What we see here is Daniel being faithful in the little things. Okay. We're only talking about four people here who didn't eat the meat and drink the wine. The assumption is, if not everybody else, the vast majority of everybody else just went along with it and did it. Okay. When in Rome, if you want to use that term. What we see is, even though this is considered a quote-unquote little thing, Daniel drew the line where God spoke, whether it was a little thing or not. Okay, this isn't, you know, thou shalt not murder, big thing. You know, this is a little thing. But guess what? Sin is sin. He understood, even at this age, he understood the covenant he was under. This is a very early recognition of Daniel's relationship with God and how much he respected his God and how much he was willing to put on the line to adhere to the ordinances of his God, or even just what his God has asked him to do, his will. That simple. It really is. And you realize most of these decisions they're making, they're very simple decisions. In and of themselves, not taking into account all the ramifications and the potential outcome of that decision. One thing I don't get, and there may have been, but I don't see this anywhere in here, there is no defiance in this defiance. Okay? This is the defiance out of adhering to the will of God. Not a defiance out of, no, I'm not doing what you want me to do because I'm not going to do it. This kind of goes ahead to the book of Romans, where we're told, as much as depends on us, live peacefully with everybody else. So this is depending on Daniel. Okay. Do I live peacefully by ignoring God's word and disobeying? Or do I live peacefully by trying to come up with let me phrase it this way. Do I live peacefully by not doing it and then becoming disrespectful and now I die? Or do I do this in some other way where I can still be peaceful and see if we can do it? Because he's not saying he's not going to do it. He's saying he's making the request to see if he can do it. He does not say he's not going to do it, which I always found was interesting. So granted, this is a what-if game. If they said no, he may have done it, but we don't know. He may have actually gone to the point of death. I would assume he would have gone that way. But he doesn't say he wouldn't do it. The request is just an open-ended request. Give us 10 days. And we'll see what happens.
But in verse 9, he kind of had a clue from God because he found favor.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, and mine it says, and tender love with the prince of eunuchs. So.
Okay. So we see here, Daniel was willing to pay the cost associated with defying the king's decree, and he did so standing on the firm ground of God's truth. Like Moses, he chose to suffer affliction with the people of God rather than with the pleasures of sin for a season. Many of us will face a decision like this at some point, and it will show our relationship with God and the trust we have in Him to take care of us in any circumstance. And then, what we're not getting into this week, we'll get into next week, is verse 9. Now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the eunuchs, or the officials. We've now gone from God being sovereign, which He hasn't changed, to now transition. God is now showing grace. And this is the interesting part, because it's not just any kind of grace. It is God gave, or God granted, grace to Daniel. This is something else God gives. Grace is that free gift. As redundant as that word is, the gift. It implies free. This is something we see. God has given Jehoiakim and Jerusalem into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. God has now given grace to Daniel, and given him the grace and mercy so that he is being seen as favorable in the eyes of his captors. In the eyes of those who are now making the decision, because here we are. They say yes. Go for it. Because Melzar knows what can happen to him if this goes badly. And he even says so in here. I'm worried about my head. My life's on the line here as well. So this is not just a decision Daniel's making in a vacuum. It's a decision that's affecting him. It's a decision that's affecting Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And the decision that's affecting his captor here. So Daniel's got a lot of, I'll use the Jewish word here, chutzpah. Okay. He's got a lot of this going on. But it's because he's grounded in who he is in his God and what his God can do for him. So next week, we're going to dig into the whole thing with the pulse, the vegetables, the whole diet thing. I'm not going into a diet discussion, okay? We're not doing that. But it's more of how he does this and what the outcome is. And then what we start to see is a transition into chapter 2 because of this, of the standard Daniel is now set for himself and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Because they set this standard early. And we see, you read the rest of the book, and that standard never changes. Okay. Doesn't matter what the outcome. And we see whether it's fire, lions, take your pick. And we're going to see, because of this standard he takes here, how God is going to bless him from chapter 2 on. I can only imagine what it would be like to be blessed of God to actually be able to interpret visions and dreams. That would just be really, really weird. Right? But that's what he does. And then... So any questions before we get out of here?
Is this where the Daniel's fast comes from?
Yes. Yeah, this whole thing about the vegetables and this whole Daniel diet and all these other things. Yeah, you can make all sorts of jokes about it. We're not even going to bother with that. It's not worth the time.
So you want everybody to eat vegetables and water until next class?
No. I will not dictate that.
I guess, I had this question before I figured it out. In this class, that I always wondered why he didn't resolve not to change his name, because symbolically he's taking God out of his name. But then what kind of came to me today during class is that wasn't maybe a law. So it wasn't, a peace and law that he was choosing not to follow.
The examples we can go to here, a lot of stuff has happened. He's in captivity. They changed his name. He went from Daniel to Belteshazzar. You got to learn all these different rules, languages, sciences, cultures of this other system, but he draws the line here. Mm-hmm. And the two examples I go to are Moses and Joseph. Joseph, taken captive, learned all the stuff the Egyptians had, had to take a new name, mm-hmm. lived as and ruled in that kingdom. Very similar to Moses, mm-hmm. Granted, mm-hmm. a little different scenario, but learned all the stuff. Not really totally took a new name, but learned all the culture. The precedent is set in there because there's nothing in God's word saying you can't take somebody else's name, you can't learn about another culture, you can't learn this, that kind of stuff.
Right. Yeah.
But you cannot eat meat sacrificed to idols.
So that was very clear.
That's where he drew the line.
Yeah.
Because the other stuff, not in the law. That's kind of that grace period of the law. Okay? There's a lot of things you can do and not do. And that's not one that's very clearly defined as no. Until we get to this, and now Daniel said, not doing it. But he does it respectfully and lovingly.
Back in Leviticus 34, it says, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants. They were to get rid of everything. They were not to become a part of, take women as their wives, any of the places that they went into. But they would not make a covenant. So he's not making a covenant.
He's actually making a covenant with God not to do it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting, we're going to get to that later on. Daniel makes a lot of things of God saying, I know you said that you're going to do this, don't not do this. Okay, it's one of those kind of things. We'll definitely see that in chapter 9 with the prayer. Okay? So let's pray and then we'll get out of here. Since we actually have time. Father, thank you again for your time just to study your word and just to open our hearts and minds to you and just see how you speak to us as you want us to interact as you call us to, Father. Thank you for Daniel as the example to live in a culture that's not too dissimilar and hostile as what we're living in now, Father. As you just fill us all with your spirit from head to toe and just open our hearts and minds to what Frank is going to speak about today, Father, and just give us the strength and the grace we need to do what you've called us to do, no matter what the circumstances in our lives, Father. I ask all this in the name of your Son, Jesus. Amen.
Amen.